In the first hour of the program today, we will be reviewing some recent events in Northern Ireland. In late January of this year, a man named Robert McCartney was killed outside a bar in Belfast, Northern Ireland. He was beaten and stabbed to death, allegedly, by members of the Irish Republican Army, who afterward told bar patrons that it was IRA business and they should forget what they had seen. Mr. McCartney's sisters, however, would not be silent. They were outraged about the death of their brother and demanded their brother's killer be brought to justice. This cause has made headlines around the world and has led many Catholics in the North to add their voices to those calling for the Irish Republican Army to disband. This morning, we'll talk about the death of Robert McCartney, perhaps also a little bit about a rather spectacular bank robbery committed in December, also in Belfast, and also attributed to the IRA, and talk a little bit about progress or perhaps lack of progress towards implementing what has been called the Good Friday Agreement that was signed back in 1998. And our guest for the program in this hour is Kevin Cullen. He is a reporter for the Boston Globe newspaper and has been for 17 years. He's reported on a number of beats. He was the newspaper's law enforcement reporter. He was legal affairs correspondent, has been a reporter at large. He wrote a column about city life for 2 years, and he also covered the conflict in Northern Ireland for more than 15 years. He moved there in 1997 to open the Globe's Dublin Bureau, and he was the only staff reporter for an American paper to cover the Irish peace process full-time in that year leading up to the Good Friday Agreement. In 1998, he was appointed the Globe's London Bureau Chief and European Correspondent, and he spent much of the next 3 years in the Balkans, covering the war in the former Yugoslavia. Since coming home, back here to the United States, he's covered the fallout from the September 11th attacks and also the sexual abuse crisis in the Catholic Church. And we are pleased that he could give us some of his time this morning. Questions, of course, are welcome as we move through the hour. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so that we can keep the program moving along and get in as many callers as possible. Anyone is welcome to join the conversation. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana. Even if you're listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you can use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Cullen, hello.
Hello.
Oh, are you there, Kevin?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah, just very faintly. I wonder if maybe we're having a little bit of a problem. My engineer guy is on the case there. He's looking around the control room, and we're trying to figure out what the problem is. Well, maybe the thing to do is to try to put the call through again. I don't know. Okay. Jason Croft is at the controls, and he's going to get this sorted out in a minute. The number here, again, for people to take part in the conversation, we hope, will be 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And we'll be talking here just a second with Kevin Cullen. Again, also a reminder, in the second part of the program today, we will speak with Michael Shermer. He's a columnist for Scientific American. He's also founder of Skeptic Magazine, and we'll be talking with him about some of the things that he writes about in a recent book, which is actually a collection of previous writings about science and what science does and how science helps us sometimes understand the world. That is, the book is titled Science Friction, Where the Known Meets the Unknown, and he will be talking with us in the second part of the show, assuming that we can get everything together here. In just a second, though, we hope that we will get onto the program. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Let us try again. Mr. Cullen.
David.
Yes, great.
Is it better?
This is much better, much, much better. Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Glad to be here.
We appreciate it. The place that I thought that I would like to start is to talk about the death of Robert McCartney. And right at the beginning, I just gave the barest thumbnail sketch, the fact that he was killed outside of this bar in Belfast. And it is alleged that the murderers were members of the IRA who afterward did everything they could to remove the evidence. They told people who were there in the bar, "This, forget what you've seen. This is IRA business," although it doesn't seem to have been a political killing at all. It just seems to have been an argument that started in a bar that got out of hand, and Mr. McCartney was killed, and a friend of his was very seriously injured. But survived. What do we know about what happened there in that bar on the 30th of January?
Well, I mean, you summarized it. It basically was a barroom dispute that escalated and turned violent, and at the end of it, Mr. McCartney was dead, and his friend Brendan Devine was very seriously injured. And as you say, it was not an IRA act per se. It was not an act that was authorized by the IRA. It was basically just a bunch of IRA guys who were hanging around this bar near the market section of Belfast. And the issue at hand is that while the IRA men involved try to pass it off as IRA business, people in the communities that have supported the IRA traditionally rose up and said this was not an IRA act. And beyond that, we're sick and tired of you guys pretending that you're protecting us, you know, when in fact you do things like this. So it was kind of a cumulative thing, because what was significant about this is that, you know, the IRA has been criticized for 35 years. It has listened to people compare it to gangsters. It has listened to the British government, the Irish government, the American government, and all sorts of people say that they are despicable human beings who should just go away. What's unique and what's unusual about this situation is that its very own supporters, people who defended the right of the IRA to exist for all those years, are now saying it's time for them to go away. And that's why we're at this point.
Yeah. I was very struck by there apparently was, there may be other polls like this, but apparently there was a poll that was carried out by the BBC and a newspaper, the Belfast Telegraph, not very long ago, mm-hmm. suggesting that even if you talk to people who identify themselves as nationalists, six out of 10, including 44% of people who said they had voted for Sinn Féin, mm-hmm. believe the IRA should disband immediately, and of those people polled, also more than half believe that in fact the IRA was responsible for this bank robbery back in December, and that seems to me to be quite striking, the fact that these people would say that, and the kind of attention that it's gotten, particularly that people have acknowledged just how courageous Mr. McCartney's sisters were, because it seems that they were the ones, if not for them, one wonders whether this would have gotten as much attention, because they were the ones who came forward and said, no, this is wrong. This doesn't have anything to do with politics.
No, I think that's true. I mean, it's ironic that when I started talking to folks over there about what happened, I very quick, with one phone call, I found out who was involved. That's how small a world it is over there. But it's interesting that one of the IRA men who was involved in this attack had been involved in another sort of situation that had nothing to do with IRA business, but in which a woman was kicked and actually lost a baby. She was pregnant, and nothing happened in those circumstances. And part of it was because I think the victim's family in this case wasn't as determined, the McCartney sisters just really took this and ran with it. They were not going to be told what to do on this. There's been a lot of communal pressure over the years for Republicans to keep this within the Republican community, not to complain about when the IRA oversteps its bounds, even with its own supporters. These women were not going to be told what to do. And I was talking to them just the other day, actually, talking to Claire McCartney, the youngest of the sisters. And I said, she was saying that all the Americans kept coming up to them last week and saying that they were brave and they were courageous. And they don't see themselves in those terms. They didn't say, oh, you know, maybe we shouldn't speak out because the IRA might do something to us. And their response was, you know, our brother's been killed. What more can they do to us that could really harm us? They are speaking basically from their gut, and that's what's resonating in communities like the Short Strand where they're from.
Mm. I want to talk a little bit more about the reaction here in the United States. And you mentioned the fact that the McCartney sisters were here in the United States last year. Last week. For St. Patrick's Day. So was Gerry Adams, leader of Sinn Féin. And for, I believe, the past 10 years, he's come to the United States on St. Patrick's Day, and he's been received at the White House. This year, for the first time, he was uninvited or not invited, and President Bush met with the McCartney sisters, as did Senators Ted Kennedy, Hillary Clinton, and John McCain. Now, I think Mr. Adams has tended to kind of brush off the snub from the White House as saying, well, this is not really a big problem. This is just a misunderstanding, and we'll get by that. But I guess I wonder how significant do you think is the fact that he was not asked to come to the White House this year?
Well, I mean, so much that involves the peace process in Northern Ireland is symbolic. And obviously the symbolism is not good when you're being stunned, shunned and snubbed. That said, I think there's a tendency on these shores to overestimate the American dimension. Americans back in the 70s sent far less money to the IRA than people would have you believe. And American involvement in the peace process at this point, as critical as it was in the mid-90s to particularly allow Mr. Adams on these shores and suggest that there was, you know, that Sinn Féin had a mandate and that they were just as, you know, they had as much right to access to the American media or any other media as anybody else in Northern Ireland. As critical as that is, I think it's generally overstated how important the American dimension is at this point. You know, that said, obviously Mr. Adams would have preferred to have been in the White House. Obviously Mr. Adams would have preferred to meet with Ted Kennedy. That said, his congressional support is pretty rock solid. The people that have been with him over the years were still with him and made a point of saying that they did not believe in excluding him, viewing him as part of the solution, not as part of the problem. But certainly the Irish government has had a large role in directing the American response, and they wanted a message to be sent to Mr. Adams that the status quo is not acceptable, that it's time for the IRA to go out of business, to go away, and that they believe Mr. Adams has to do more to affect that change.
We'll take a caller in here in just a second. Let me take a moment to introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Kevin Cullen. He's a reporter for the Boston Globe, has been working for the paper for quite a long time, and for something like 15 years covered the conflict in Northern Ireland. He's joining us this morning by telephone. As we continue to talk, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also a toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have a couple of callers here to talk with. Let's go first to someone listening in Charleston, and that's line number 4. Hello.
Yes, for enlightenment, I'm wondering if your guest can take us back into history and in Northern Ireland, if I am understanding the rule, and I've always had difficulty with this, that they are loyal to the crown, and that there is a gentleman that began and who is still living, who is totally and utterly anti-IRA and or joining the two Irelands together. Could you elaborate on that for a minute, and then I have another question?
I assume you're talking about Dr. Paisley.
Ian Paisley, yes.
The Democratic Unionist Party, which is now the largest party representing Protestant Unionists. These are people in Northern Ireland who want to remain part of the United Kingdom. Yeah, Mr. Paisley, like everybody in Northern Ireland, has changed his position somewhat in the last 10 years. And by all indications, Mr. Paisley and his party were willing to share power with Sinn Féin if, in fact, the IRA would agree to completely disarm and go away. But the deal ended up crashing on the rocks in December, because part of what Mr. Paisley was demanding was that there would be photographic evidence of the destruction of IRA weapons, and that evidence would be published. And the IRA saw that as beyond the beyonds, that it was an attempt to humiliate them, and that they would not go that far. And so it's not the only reason the deal collapsed. It ostensibly was the reason that it collapsed. But anyway, there we are.
Yes, and then the efforts of Mr. Paisley and the anti-Catholic, now, I have a difficulty keeping these all threaded together. IRA then represents the Catholics of Ireland, whereas, and what are the Orangemen then, the Protestant minority that is loyal?
Well, I mean, the IRA specifically represents Republicans. These are people who would believe that they have the right to use force to end British involvement in the affairs of the island of Ireland.
Yes.
But that is a subset of Catholics. And then most Catholics, which make up the majority of people in the Republic of Ireland, would reject that. They don't accept that there's a right to use force, physical force in that matter. But no, the Orange Men would be referred to a fraternal organization that represents a portion of the Protestant community in Northern Ireland. They would tend to have very anti-Catholic rhetoric.
Yes.
It would tend to be like a lot of religious organizations that would be very exclusionary in their view. And these are the folks that over the last 10 years, it's been, I mean, they've been marching for, you know, decades, but the last 10 years it's been very contentious because Orange Men insist on marching through neighborhoods where they're not wanted, saying that it's the Queen's Highway, whereas, you know, nationalists respond, hey, you know, you guys are just walking through our neighborhoods to drive us crazy.
Yes, well, there again is the conflict, and this is an age-old conflict, is it not?
Oh, yeah.
That dates back for a long, long time. I can't put a time frame on it, but it has been this conflict of Protestantism. Was King Henry VIII was part of all that, was he not?
But like I said, the problem in Ireland is if you focus on the history, you're never going to get beyond the present. So
yes, well, I understand.
That's why a lot of the peace process is focusing on letting go of that. And,
yes, well,
that's what's been the last decade has been about getting Ireland to focus on the future as opposed to the past.
Yes, well, that is a huge difficulty for any grouping of people, especially when religious overtones have possessed the thing, the same as in the Arabic countries or even in the U.S., you know, with slavery and capitalism. So it just is fraught with its problems. But
no, you're right. It just shows how universal these are. I mean, I spent obviously a long time covering Northern Ireland, and everybody wanted to talk about 1690, and then when I got to Kosovo, everybody wanted to talk about the 14th century. So I seem to be moving my way back in history with these areas.
Well, there's one other thing. There was a young man who went on a starvation campaign in prison.
Bobby Sands.
Sands, that's the one. And that happened in the 1980s, did it not?
1981.
81, yes. Well, but that's what those events, that's why I have such a hard time with understanding the history. If you can't understand the history, then you can't understand the events.
Absolutely.
And so it is one of those things. Well, thank you very much, sir, and it has been very nice talking to you.
Right,
thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. Just a couple of other things that probably it's good to make clear. Well, first of all, one thing we should make clear is that there are paramilitaries on both sides of this conflict.
Absolutely.
And there are Protestant paramilitaries as well as the Catholic.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that kind of gets under the skin of Republicans. They feel like there's an obsession with focusing just on their paramilitaries, and that, you know, loyalists are the ones who are actually out there actively still killing people. But one of the differences is that, you know, we're talking about the IRA, which is affiliated with the largest nationalist party in Northern Ireland, one that's about to resume control or be part of a government, whereas the loyalists really are affiliated with very small, negligible political parties who have absolutely no power. So there is a distinction, but it is true. And I think the other problem here with with focusing almost exclusively on the McCartney murder, it tends to obliterate all the other people who have been killed over the years, and that creates hard feelings. And as celebrated as the McCartney sisters were in Ireland, in America last week, I could hear among the people that were there from Northern Ireland sort of the begrudgery already starting back in Ireland, and people were jealous that they were in America, who was paying for their trip. All this sort of baggage that comes around, it's a typically Irish response in these things. But there is a legitimate concern. I mean, one story I wrote about last week from Washington is that the family of Patrick Finucan, who was a solicitor, a lawyer who represented paramilitary figures, most often IRA members, who was murdered 16 years ago, and there's strong evidence that there were collusion between the loyalist gunmen who killed him and forces in the British security forces. So it's been 16 years since he was killed, and we really don't know a heck of a lot more than what happened 16 years ago. His family is still fighting for what they would see as justice for him. So, and, you know, there is a tendency to focus on the latest atrocity in Northern Ireland. That's been sort of the history of the coverage of it over the last 30 years. But if there's really going to be peace and, more importantly, reconciliation, I think all of the conflict and all of the losses and all of the injustices have to be dealt with equally.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone else here, a caller in a nearby community of Belgium, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. The troubles were really rooted in the poverty of Ireland. And now Ireland has changed from being rather poor to being a very wealthy nation very rapidly. I wonder how that's going to change this set of problems.
Well, I mean, I think you've touched on something. I never bought it that it was just poor people lashing out. I mean, my sense is that particularly on the IRA side, most people I met that have been in the IRA, it wasn't about I'm poor, so I'm going to join a paramilitary organization. There was a sense of injustice at the end of the 60s. And then when the conflict turned violent, there was sort of a crackdown that alienated the entire nationalist community because everybody was seen as being in the IRA. And there were a lot of young kids that joined the IRA to hit back. And, you know, it's human nature. We see it in Iraq today. I mean, a lot of the people that are insurgents in Iraq, you know, they might not have been predisposed to that before that they saw as what an occupying army in their own midst would be. So it's sort of human nature. It's not unique to Ireland. It's not unique to any conflict situation. But there's no doubt that particularly in the south of Ireland, the Republic of Ireland went from being one of the poorest countries when it joined the EU, in 1973, it is now one of the richest countries in the in the world. It's actually its per income capita just went past the United States this past year. So the average person in Ireland earns more money than the average person in America, in the United States. So that thing definitely, the sort of economic progress in the South kind of changed the dynamic. It changed the whole argument about a united Ireland, too, because, you know, unionists in the North would always say, you know, who wants to be part of this clerically dominated economic backwater that we call the Republic of Ireland? Well, now the Republic of Ireland is richer than the United Kingdom. The people have a higher standard of living than they do in the United Kingdom, although because Northern Ireland has been so heavily subsidized in the last 30-odd years because of the conflict, that's not necessarily true when you compare Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. But certainly the economics have made a major, it's been a major impetus for changing and bringing on the peace process because so many of the old shibboleths about the south of Ireland have just evaporated with economic progress.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right. Thanks for the call. Other people who are listening are welcome to call if you have questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We're about at our midpoint here, and our guest is Kevin Cullen. He's a reporter for the Boston Globe, has worked for the paper for 17 years. In 1997, he moved to Ireland to open the Globe's Dublin Bureau. He was the only staff reporter for an American paper to cover the Irish peace process full-time in the year leading up to the Good Friday Agreement. He also, in 1998, became the paper's London bureau chief and European correspondent. He covered the war in the former Yugoslavia and also has now, back in the United States, been one of the reporters at the Globe, and this has involved a lot of people, obviously, one of the reporters who was involved in covering the sexual abuse crisis in the Catholic Church. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The Sinn Féin is the largest nationalist party in Northern Ireland, and forever, as long as I can remember, whenever in stories one refers to Sinn Féin, the phrase that is always appended to that is the political arm of the IRA. Mm-hmm. And I think that certainly in recent years now, Sinn Féin has tried to distance itself from the IRA, even while people have been charging that the leaders of Sinn Féin, Gerry Adams, Martin McGuinness, are said to be, even to this day, high-ranking members of the IRA, which is something that they deny. Right. What exactly is the connection between Sinn Féin and the IRA?
Well, I mean, there's certainly a lot of, you know, cross-fertilization there. I mean, all I can tell you is that, you know, high-ranking security people both in the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland and you know, in Britain also have told me, like they've told other reporters, that they believe Adams, McGuinness, and Pat Doherty, who are very senior members of Sinn Féin, obviously, have also been at various times members of the IRA's Army Council, which is the seven-person ruling body of the IRA. You know, the distinctions, you have to understand, Sinn Féin is trying to make a distinction that, you know, they put, like every other political party, they stand candidates. These are people who have to get an a Democratic mandate, and they go out and do what a lot of politicians do, which is, you know, get potholes filled, argue for more nurses at the local hospital, and they do all those things. But, you know, I also think it's obvious. There have been so many examples of people that have been, you know, involved in both organizations at various times when they're in the Republican movement. That I think it reminds me of when we argued the distinction about whether NORAD, the American support group of the IRA, was sending money to the IRA or whether they were sending money, as they just said, to the families of political prisoners. The bottom line is that the IRA was responsible for its prisoners and the welfare of their families. So if you sent money to their families, well, in fact, you were helping the IRA. So it's a distinction that I think there's way too much time spent on it. The connections between the IRA and Sinn Féin are inextricable, and they are, you know, they have been tied. They are the two arms of the Republican movement. I think what's going on and why this is so, it's historic, it's also controversial, and it's very convoluted, is that for, you know, the last century, the Republican movement has been driven, that the primary driver of it has been those on the physical force side, the, you know, what has been called the Irish Republican Army through various incarnations, you know, beginning with the 1916 rising in Dublin. But now we're at a point, there's this process, this transition, where the political arm of the movement is taking over. And obviously there are people that are coming with it, there are people that are falling to the wayside, there are people who believe that the IRA has to stay until the very last possible moment, and there are people who I know within Sinn Féin who really wish they would go away, particularly because they believe they will not seize power or have a chance to exercise power in the Republic of Ireland until there really is no Irish Republican Army.
Before the McCartney story, probably the last big news item that we would have heard about here in the United States concerning the IRA was the bank robbery.
Right.
This was in Belfast on December 20th, £26.5 million, I think is the number that I saw.
Yeah,
spectacular.
It's about $50 million.
It was a lot of money, and the IRA has been blamed. Now, and also some of the recent stories that I have read, there have been comments, again, about the leadership of Sinn Féin, and comments something to the effect like, oh, for example, there was no way that Gerry Adams could not have known that this thing was planned.
I don't know how to comment on that because, you know, I don't know how he could know. Who knows? I mean, maybe he knew, maybe he didn't, but there has certainly not been any incontrovertible evidence that would say that the Sinn Féin leadership knew about the robbery. Neither has there been incontrovertible evidence that the IRA was involved in the robbery. That said, there's an old line in Northern Ireland that even the dogs in the street know something. And I don't know anybody. I was in, you know, West Belfast not that long ago, and people were laughing about it. They weren't taking that big. I mean, I talked to a guy I've known for 15 years. He served 15 years in prison for the IRA. You know, he was a 19-year-old kid when he shot a British soldier, and he's still obviously a Republican. And when I asked him, you know, who he thought did the robbery, his response was, at least I'll get me pension. Which was sort of like everybody in, you know, in Republican areas believes that the IRA did it. That doesn't mean they did, and we don't know what the semantics are. Maybe there are people that, but the amount of precision, the military precision of the operation, and more importantly, that there's very little things like that that could happen in Northern Ireland that the IRA wouldn't know about it. But like I said, it's so hard because you have governments making allegations without backing them up with evidence, and then they can honestly say, well, we can't reveal the evidence because this is under investigation. So we in this business have trouble, you know, saying declaratively one way or the other. But it's the same thing, you know, we go back to, you know, is Gerry Adams on the Army Council? I mean, I have cops telling me that he is, but, you know, can I sit here and swear that he is? I don't know. I can only report what they say.
Well, we got some more callers here ready to talk with. Let's do that next, Champaign County, and it's line number one. Hello.
Hi. The way you dismissed the idea that poverty had anything to do with people joining the IRA. It's a complicated issue, but and I only have an afternoon in Belfast, and but I toured both a community center that was obviously built for the British sympathetic side, and I toured a community center that was in Shankill Road that was surrounded by barbed wire and observation towers, and with people with automatic rifles, the British on the street, some years ago. But the contrast was stunning, and the idea that there isn't partially an economic dimension of this is, I don't know that you really were saying that.
No, I wasn't dismissing it. I said it tended to be overemphasized in the sense that, and I think the British government particularly overemphasized it during the 70s, 80s, and said if we could only get these people jobs, they wouldn't join the paramilitaries. And they were they were equating it to sort of like, if you would only get a kid in our inner cities a job, he wouldn't mug you. And I don't think it was that simple. I don't accept that on both sides, people only join the paramilitaries because absent a political cause, they would join criminal gangs. I just didn't see that in my experience because, like I said, most people I knew who joined the IRA, and for that matter, the loyalist groups, didn't get rich off it. And, you know, I always remember what, you know, Joe McDonald's mother said to me, one of the hunger strikers, after her son died. I was sitting there, having a cup of tea with her in the living room. And I said, Mrs. McDonald, I don't know quite how to ask you this, but, some people say that, your son was not a freedom fighter or a noble guy. He was a criminal. And she looked at me and she said, criminals don't starve themselves to death.
Well, yeah. But it seemed to me the circumstance was so humiliating for one side, and I don't know what's happened subsequently, whether, obviously you don't just give a person a job. The whole community right. needed to be affirmed in some way.
No, I think you just hit it on. I think it is there was a sense of injustice and that the playing field wasn't level, and that it was blatantly tilted toward one side, and that all the government was controlled by one part of the community, that the other part of the community, even though it was a minority, it was a sizable minority, was not afforded there was no recognition of what we call in this country minority rights. And, the irony is that now some of the greatest indexes of poverty and deprivation are actually in loyalist areas. And one of the reasons that is that in the Catholic areas where people were traditionally poor and put upon, they were better at grant writing. They were better at trying to take advantage of some of the things that were there for people in deprived areas. Whereas in the loyalist areas, they tended to rely on jobs that were afforded to them by birthright. So in the shipyards, in some of the places. In Belfast particularly, those jobs have dried up as the economy has changed, and they're not as prepared for poverty as the Catholics were, 30-odd years ago. But you're absolutely right. I think you hit on it, that it's really about a sense of injustice.
Isn't there also some knock-on effect from the fact that the European community and the transfer payments to the Irish economy and just the burgeoning of the Irish Republic has that some of that investment and some of those ties would have actually brought up people into some better standard of living.
Yeah, well, I don't know if the Europeans, I mean, Northern Ireland is the most heavily subsidized part of Europe and has been for over 30 years. That's almost entirely from the British Exchequer. There's not a lot of European money in the north. The south, clearly, it benefited tremendously from its membership in the European Union, and then subsequently its own economy took off, driven largely by low taxes, corporate taxes, like a third of what the Germans and the French were offering. And every American software company is in the south of Ireland now. In fact, there's more software produced in Ireland than any place in the world except the United States, which is remarkable given you're talking about a place smaller than the size of New England. It's not a big place. And the economic development in the South, I think the knock-on effect you're talking about, I think what it did is
is kind of force people to deal with the real realities and not on these old myths about Ireland being run by the, you know, the Vatican and having this, you know, the economy that was just a joke. And it's not a joke. It's one of the healthiest economies in Europe and has been for about 15 years.
I hope the call will forgive me for jumping in here. My lines are full, and we're into our last 15 minutes of the show, and I'd like to get in some other callers. Also, I just quickly introduce again our guest. We're talking with Kevin Cullen. He's a reporter with the Boston Globe newspaper, and for quite a few years covered Northern Ireland, has continued to follow politics in Northern Ireland. Our number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next up is a caller in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Yeah, I've got a comment and a question. The comment is, I understand that today, actually, in France, they're issuing a BBC TV movie called Oma, speaking of those past things that haven't been reconciled. And in the little blurb I saw, they said that the this bombing, which killed 29 people back in 1998, the authorities knew that the bombing was planned and where it was going to occur, etc. But they didn't warn anybody because they wanted to protect their informant. And apparently, I don't know if you know anything about that.
Yeah, I was in Oma when it happened. I mean, that allegation has been out there, but any major atrocity in Northern Ireland when multiple people have been killed, you can almost find a conspiracy theory. There's always somebody willing to make the allegation. You know, one of the problems with that allegation is that the police did issue a warning, and that the police actually, you know, shepherded people away from the warning where they said the bomb was, but the bomb was actually in a car that had not been moved because the bombers had panicked and left the car there and then made the warning. Then you'd have to believe that the cops, including the cops themselves, stood near the bomb so that more people would die. I've been covered this thing for long enough to say that almost every major atrocity in Northern Ireland has a conspiracy, a theory attached to it, and Oma is no different.
Hmm. Well, that's an interesting counter to that. But my question actually was more about the EU and its effects on the whole troubles and all that. I was just curious if you...
The EU kind of kept out of it, you know, mm-hmm. because the EU, they're forced in, they have two member countries, which up until, you know, the Irish government actually changed its claim to the territory of Northern Ireland as part of the 1998 agreement. So you had two member countries, the United Kingdom and the Republic of Ireland, laying claim to the same swath of land. So it's the same reason, you know, the UN has not been involved in the conflict in Northern Ireland. The competing demands or the competing claims have just led those bodies to stay out of it, because it would be almost impossible to take a stand one way or the other, because you'd be siding with one member against the other.
Well, what about human rights issues, though?
Well, I mean, the human rights issues have been, you know, present, and human rights organizations have been a pressure group in Northern Ireland from the very beginning. And they've played a particularly, you know, I think a useful role, particularly in helping resolve the conflict toward the end. And now, you know, have kept the focus on that, you know, the changes that had to occur. And when you address some of the human rights violations, you actually remove some of the grievances that people, the paramilitaries, would cite for the reason they had to continue fighting.
And you're saying that, but the EU itself really didn't.
Yeah, they haven't done much. Like I said, they've mm-hmm. left it to the British and the Irish to sort out. And, you know, at the end of the day, that's really what it's had to be anyway. The American involvement was dramatic and very important when it occurred. But, you know, right now we're at a spot where it really is. I think Jerry Adams said this in Washington, or he said it in New York last week. It won't be resolved in New York. It won't be resolved in Washington. It's going to be resolved on the island of Ireland.
Yeah, let's talk with another caller, someone on a cell phone in the Bloomington area here, line number 4. Hello.
Hello, good morning.
Yes.
I have two questions about the IRA. Allegedly with the bank robbery on December 20th and other operations that display a very high level of sophistication, where do they get their, I guess, their training or their, highly, military sophisticated, tactics? Is it something that, ex-military people are part of the IRA and it's just passed on? And also, what role, historically or even recently, do women take in the IRA in terms of actually taking, action in, bombings or kidnappings or so on? And since I'm on a cell phone, I'll take this off the air, take the answer off the air.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call.
The military training, the IRA, is it's literally been learned on the job experience for them. But, I mean, it's ironic when you think about it that the British Army often regarded Northern Ireland as a laboratory for themselves to test different tactics and how to contain an insurgency, that sort of thing. And obviously the IRA did the same thing. So it was almost it was learn as you go. And, I mean, when I talk to guys particularly from the early 70s when the place was going crazy, in fact, I mentioned that former IRA man who told me that he regards the bank robbery as his pension fund. He was like a 19-year-old kid, didn't know anything about it. He just took a gun, went out on a roof, and shot a guy. So it's basically and then it developed. Obviously, the IRA developed a lot of techniques when it came to bombing, a lot of techniques of insurgency, urban insurgency, using an insurgency in sort of the bucolic lanes of South Armagh, where it was very dangerous for the British Army to patrol. So, I mean, they learned as they went, and they got more sophisticated as they went along. And obviously, there was some training in the Middle East, particularly in the 70s. They trained with some. With Palestinians, with the PLO, things like that, and they've also trained with the Basque over the years. The second part of the question.
The question was about the role of women and whether women, in fact, participate in a direct
way. No, they have been. I mean, there have been a number of women volunteers in the IRA over the years, obviously far fewer than men. And I was actually talking to Anthony McIntyre, a former IRA member who's now very critical of the Sinn Féin leadership. He contends that there has never been a woman on the Army Council, that seven-member ruling body. There's never been a woman on it in its 35 years of existence, which I was surprised to hear, because the Republican movement styles itself very progressive, socialist, and would, at least ostensibly or at least rhetorically view women as equals. But, seriously, there haven't been a lot of identifiable leaders that were women in the IRA, though I know a number of women who were in the IRA. I mean, I just saw Rita O'Hare, who's the Sinn Féin representative in Washington, and she's considered a distinguished former IRA volunteer. It was Mairead Farrell, who was killed in Gibraltar by British commandos, and there are a number of women who would have high profiles, but like I said, you can more or less be assured that they would be a small number of active IRA volunteers.
The next caller is in Vermilion County, next door to us here, line number 3. Hello.
I'd like to know one thing. Why don't you let us vote in the North? I was over there for the Bloody Sunday March this year, and they still won't let vote, but they promised to next August, but now they've put that off for another year.
What vote, sir? A vote for who or what?
To have elections in Northern Ireland.
Well, there will be elections in May when there will be a general a British general election.
A British general election.
Right. Are you talking about a referendum on the whole island?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't think you're going to see that for a long time.
Well, it's supposed to have been done this year.
No. It was never really set in stone when there was going to be a referendum. They left that purposely vague in the Good Friday Agreement. They acknowledged that someday there would be a referendum and that people would vote whether they would want to, join with the Republic of Ireland. But there was never a date set on that. It was left purposely vague.
Well, it's supposed to be in 96 now. I mean, 06. It was 05, now it's 06. That's 8 years ago.
Well, that's news to me, but I could be wrong. I'm wrong every day, so maybe I'm wrong on this.
Well, I was over there, March 20,000 people, mm-hmm. in January 30th
yep.
this year.
Okay.
It's but you're right on the economy. The economy is fabulous over there. Everybody's working, and they do lots of work for Japanese people.
Absolutely.
Companies.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. One thing I do, Kevin, want to make sure that we talk a little bit about is the Belfast Agreement, the Good Friday Agreement, and the fact that it did call for the formation of an assembly and a power-sharing executive, and those things indeed were created back in 1999. However, in 2002, they both fell apart. The unionists walked out after revelations that the IRA was, I guess, essentially involved in spying,
right,
spying on the opposition. And it's my understanding that still now that they're still suspended.
That was the deal that collapsed in December. They were trying to make a deal that that Sinn Féin would agree to sit on police. That what would happen is if the unionist, because from a nationalist perspective, they're still not completely sure that particularly the Democratic unionists led by Mr. Paisley are prepared to share power with Irish nationalists. And so the deal was going to be the DUP would agree to do that. In return, Sinn Féin would sign up to the policing board, which they have resisted, because once Sinn Féin sits on the policing board, that is in effect saying that there is no need for the IRA. The IRA should go away, because in a Republican mind, the police for them has been the IRA for the last 35 years. So that was going to be part of it, and you know, it was like everything else. I've always said that people in Northern Ireland are wonderful singers, but they're not great dancers together, so everything has to be very choreographed. And this deal was obviously choreographed, but it collapsed, as I said, ostensibly on the idea that the DUP was insisting on the IRA, you know, weapon destruction being photographed, which the IRA saw as humiliation, which is, you know, the other argument that could be suggested is both the DUP and Sinn Féin prefer to wait for another election, which now looks like it's going to happen in May, in which they would solidify their own bases and that they would kind of put even more room between the other moderate parties in unionism and nationalism, and that then strengthened electorally, they would have a better position to make a deal and one that would last.
One of the big main provisions of the Good Friday Agreement was that the paramilitaries on both sides would give up their weapons, and that seems
right.
to have been be all along a major stumbling block. There was a 2-year target set for doing that, so now we're almost 5 years past
right.
that date. Does that continue to be the major or a major problem?
I don't think the actual weapons themselves, I always thought was sort of a red herring. Because the bottom line is the IRA could give everything tomorrow, and then, first of all, how would we know it's everything? And second of all, what would prevent them from rearming themselves? And since the fall of the Soviet Union, frankly, Europe is one big shopping mart when it comes to weapons. When I was in Kosovo a few years ago, I remember a kid coming up to me with a pillowcase full of grenades and asked me if I wanted to buy some grenades. I said no, but I bought some CDs from him instead. I mean, this is the kind of place it is. So the weapons themselves, it's more about the intent. And I think between the bank robbery, the McCartney murder, and people saying, you know, what is the IRA's intent? Is their intent to really go out of business, or do they want to, like, wink, wink, nod, nod, and continue as if nothing, that they are still, you know, in their minds, authorized to do this kind of activity because they don't accept the legitimacy of not only the Northern State but the Republic of Ireland, and so that what they're engaged in is not really criminal activity. And that's where we are right now. The guns will take care of themselves. They always would. It was really about the IRA's intent and obviously the loyalist intent, too. Are they going to continue to kill Catholics at random? And that's not been answered, and hasn't been a lot of pressure on the loyalists to answer that question, because obviously I think most people are saying that if the IRA goes away and things normalize, the police will do a better job of containing the loyalist threat. Now, a lot of Republicans wouldn't accept that.
Yeah, we only have about a minute left. I want to ask a question about demographics, because apparently demographers say that at some point mm-hmm. the populations in the north of Catholics and Protestants will draw close to even, with a slight edge to the Protestants. And given the fact that most, if not all, of the Protestants favor are unionists, and most but not all the Catholics are nationalists. Does if we could, as a previous caller suggested, if we could have a referendum, do you think that most there would be more people voting for continue the connection with the UK than for joining up with the rest of Ireland?
Well, I think that's all to play for. I don't think it's a strict demographic, because there are a lot of Catholics that wouldn't vote for United Ireland because they have a better deal in the north. They might have a better tax rate depending on their status. They might have everything might be better there. But I think it, like I said, it's not going to be done just on religion or national aspirations. I think it's going to be, can national aspirations be protected in both places? Can you feel an equal part of the society if you're a Catholic nationalist in the north? Can you feel an equal part of the society if you're a Protestant who lives in the south of Ireland? Those are all things that are are in play. And that's why when you get beyond a peace process and you get into a reconciliation process, then all bets are off. Everybody's on equal grounds. And then you talk about creating a society where you want to live. And by that time, if we get to that point, I think the old labels won't apply anymore. And, people will have to make up their own mind where they would prefer to live.
Well, there we'll have to leave it. Kevin, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Our guest, Kevin Cullen, he's a reporter for the Boston Globe, has worked for the paper for 17 years. In 1997, he moved to Ireland and opened the Globe's Dublin bureau. He was the only staff reporter for an American paper to cover the Irish peace process full-time in that year leading up to the Good Friday Agreement.